Hello, I'm Lucy Ash, and welcome to the final programme in our series on the Iraq War here on the BBC World Service. In 2006, 3 years after the fall of Saddam, America still had 128,000 troops in Iraq. President Bush summed up their strategy.
Our strategy can be summed up this way. As the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down.
But by the summer of 2006, even the plan of eventual withdrawal was looking less likely. Bush's top Iraq advisor, Megan O'Sullivan, received a phone call from a friend in Baghdad begging the Americans to stay.
She said, if the Americans leave, we will descend into mass killings and violence. So please, please, please make sure that the Americans stay. It is the only thing keeping us alive.
President Bush gathered his Iraq team. Stephen Hadley was Deputy National Security Advisor.
The president turned to me and he said, our strategy is not working, Hadley. We need a new strategy.
My basic concern was that it was important that we not just walk away, that we had to win, that we had to have a victory.
Vice President Dick Cheney. Hopes of a successful withdrawal by the US lay with the new Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki. During the meeting, the president told Hadley they would need to help al-Maliki.
The president said very clearly, we need to help him. I need to help him. He's never led a country before. He's certainly never led a country in this difficult and challenging a time.
Baghdad, a year before Nouri al-Maliki became prime minister in 2006. Iraq's capital had always been home to members of the two biggest Muslim sects, the Sunni and the Shia. Abu Abed, a Sunni, had been a military intelligence officer under Saddam. In August 2005, his family were targeted by a Shia death squad. His story is horrific.
The raid lasted from 4 until 7 in the morning. They blocked the roads. Then they started arresting people.
Under Saddam's regime, the Shia majority had been oppressed. Now they were in control. Their militias operated freely from government ministries.
There were dozens of men in military gear and helmets. The Ministry of Interior insignia was on their cars. A group of them went into my father's house. They beat up my father. He was 80.
His brother was taken away and killed.
He was handcuffed. The handcuffs were metal. His fingers had been chopped off. His eyes were gouged out. They had cut off his ears.
It was clear to opposition leader Saleh al-Mutla that the militias were resources of what was now a Shia majority government.
These militias were state-supported in every detail. Their vehicles belonged to the state. Their weapons belonged to the state. Their communications gear belonged to the state. Their logistical support came from the state. These militias weren't acting alone.
Ibrahim al-Jafari, a Shia, was prime minister in 2005. He rejected the charge from Sunni politicians that the government was killing their people. He said the only Sunnis they were targeting were extremists belonging to al-Qaeda.
We are in a state of war. This is the most dangerous type of war. We're not fighting an army. No border separates us from the enemy.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq were determined to destroy the Shia-led government. The first step was to provoke a civil war. A huge Al-Qaeda bomb ripped apart one of the holiest shrines in Shia Islam, the Al-Askari Mosque. The target was well chosen. It was bound to provoke the Shia militias to retaliate against the Sunnis. General George Casey decided to visit the Prime Minister with the US Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad.
I went to Prime Minister Jafri with the ambassador and said, Prime Minister, this is a significant situation and it requires the immediate action of your government to resolve. And we strongly recommend that you apply a curfew.
He suggested a curfew, but most of the cabinet didn't agree.
Al-Jafari, who led a religious party, did not dare to clamp down on his fellow Shia. Ambassador Khalilzad realised his choices were limited.
It was clear to me that he was under enormous pressure from his constituents, and that things had gone too far. The government had been ineffective in protecting the Shia population.
What Prime Minister Jaffe expressed to me was that this is a significant attack on the Shia population of Iraq, and that they needed to let off steam, in his words.
Revenge attacks against Sunnis began that night. After hundreds of deaths, al-Jafari finally ordered a curfew. Al-Jafari's hesitancy had already brought him political difficulties. Following the elections, he was struggling to put together a new coalition government. Back in Washington, the Americans had been waiting for 10 weeks. President Bush decided to call his ally, British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
President Bush and I really discussed how to make progress in circumstances where it was obvious that the present Prime Minister, whatever his merits, didn't have the executive capacity to really drive through the changes necessary.
The president had run out of patience with al-Jafari. Brett McGurk, Iraq Director, U.S. National Security Council.
The president really put his foot down and said, we've bet on a lame horse long enough, and we have to try to find an alternative to Jafari.
If the prime minister could be persuaded to stand aside, another leader could be chosen from amongst other Shia parties that won the election. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her British counterpart, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, delivered the bad news to al-Jafari.
Condi and I decided we need to find a moment to come pay Dr. Jafari a fraternal visit.
It is not my responsibility or the responsibility of Secretary Straw to determine who is going to be the Prime Minister of Iraq. That can only be determined by Iraqis.
In private, it became clear that Secretary Rice would use all her diplomatic skills on al-Jafari.
Dr. Rice was being very polite. She'd never been so gentle with me before. Never before had I seen Dr. Rice being so feminine.
Ambassador Khalilzad.
She was quite effective, I thought. She praised him for being one of the initial leaders of Iraq, the father of a new Iraq, and that he had done great things in terms of what he had achieved already.
Jack Straw was a little more blunt in his approach.
I talked to Jaffari, as it were, politician to politician, and said this was a rough game in politics, but if you didn't have majority support, you had to go. That he needed to think about the fact that he had plainly, in our judgment, lost confidence and couldn't sustain a government.
I asked, what if Mr. Bush announced to America that he was stepping down as president? What if Tony Blair announced that he'd had enough? What would the Americans and British think if their elected leaders abandoned their responsibilities?
As it happens, the United States and the United Kingdom are the people who are delivering whatever security your people have got here and putting in the money. So we're very, very sorry. But our judgment is that you cannot sustain a democratically elected government. You're going to have to move aside for somebody who can.
Dr. al-Jafari grudgingly gave in.
I give up my right as Iraq's democratically elected leader.
The Americans knew that al-Jafari's successor would have to be another Shia leader. The problem for the US was that many of them had lived in neighbouring Iran during their exile. There was no way the Americans would support a prime minister who could be a pawn for their biggest enemy in the Middle East. The number two, Nouri al-Maliki, caught the Americans' eye for one good reason, says Stephen Hadley, National Security Advisor.
Maliki was really a pretty unknown quantity, but we did know that he had spent his time in Syria rather than Iran during the period of Saddam Hussein, and that was a source of some reassurance.
Al-Maliki was approved.
The people are suffering from murder, terrorism, and oppression. They have given us the responsibility to act. We will, God willing, rise to the challenge.
At Camp David, President Bush gave a press conference, pledging his backing for the new leader.
We're encouraged by the formation of a unity government, and we recognize our responsibilities to help that new government. Whatever we do will be toward a strategy of victory. Thank you.
Bush had gathered his senior advisers at the presidential retreat to discuss whether the new Iraqi government needed a fresh American strategy. Vice President Dick Cheney says they consulted General Casey, the commander in Iraq, by video link.
I said the longer that we stayed in Iraq in force, the more the Iraqis relied on us to solve their problems, and the less they did to resolve their problems. We would have to draw down to win.
I thought at that point that was too soon. My basic concern was that it was important that we not just walk away, that we had to win, that we had to have a victory, and we had to leave behind a stable, democratically elected government with an adequately trained and sized force.
President Bush seemed less concerned by the strategy and more with who was going to implement it. Steve Hadley.
The president focused on the importance of Maliki right from the get-go. And one of the things he said was, this man's never led a country before, never led a country facing the challenges that Iraq faces. We've got to help him succeed. I've got to help him succeed. I got to help him learn how to lead his country. Because in the end of the day, we can't succeed without Maliki succeeding in Iraq.
Meanwhile, the president had a trick up his sleeve. First of all, he dismissed his team for the night. Only a few people were privy to his plan, according to Cheney and Hadley.
Secret Service obviously played a major role in the whole operation. I think Condi knew, probably Rumsfeld knew as well, too, that the president was going to sneak out from Camp David.
The next morning when they all convened again and looked around for the president, he popped up in a video screen, courtesy of Baghdad.
I've come to not only look you in the eye, I've also come to tell you that when America gives its word, it will keep its word.
The most important thing for the president to do now was to show his support for al-Maliki, but the prime minister was in a precarious position. Other leaders were much more popular amongst his fellow Shia, especially in Sadr City, home to 3 million Shia and the heartland of the most active Shia militia, whose leader was Muqtada al-Sadr. This song praises Muqtada. It goes, "You are the crown on our heads." He had won a huge following among all Shia in Iraq with his fierce opposition to the American occupation in Najaf in 2003.
Occupiers, if you stay, you will be destroyed. Resistance is the natural reaction to occupation and oppression.
Muqtada al-Sadr's political wing had won enough seats in parliament to make or break al-Maliki's governing coalition. A few days after al-Maliki became prime minister, the Americans targeted Sadr's militia. This would prove to be the first test of al-Maliki's leadership. General George Casey.
We had an operation in Sadr City where we employed a gunship that shoots grenades the size of your fist and makes sounds pretty loud. And the prime minister was upset about that because they called me that night and said they're bombing Sadr City.
I was surprised he didn't consult me. I said, not everyone there is in a militia. Many are innocent, poor people.
The prime minister laid down conditions for General Casey's operation.
And so what he asked me to do is not to conduct any attacks in Sadr City against particular individuals. And I think we had a list of 10 or a dozen individuals that we would not target without his approval.
Al-Maliki was also insistent that his approval would be needed for operations in Muqtada al-Sadr's strongholds. A few days later, General Casey needed such approval. To back up his argument, he showed the Prime Minister a video recorded by a US drone plane over Sadr City.
We had the computer and we sat the computer right down at a table in front of him, sat him down and said, push the button, and said, Prime Minister, you need to see this.
The film showed two cars, Opals. They kidnapped two innocent passers-by, ordinary people on their way home from work. They drove them outside the city. They shot them and returned.
The American drone had tracked the killers back to a local base of Muqtada al-Sadr.
I said, Prime Minister, we need to go into this facility tonight. They're probably going to use this time to clear out any evidence out of the facility, and anything we do after this is probably going to be too late.
I told him, perhaps you don't realize how dangerous this could be. It must first be agreed by our National Security Council.
Al-Maliki asked the general and Ambassador Khalilzad for time.
He had said to us, don't do the military thing, let me do it, deal with it politically, because they are my friends, they will listen to me.
They decided that it was too volatile and that he didn't want us to conduct any operations there. And the ambassador and I thought to ourselves, this is not a very good start.
A few weeks later, all hell broke loose. The battle for Baghdad began. The details of the conflict are shocking. Al-Qaeda attacked the Shia in Sadr city with a car bomb, killing 62 people. A week later, Shia militia in another neighborhood set up checkpoints to identify Sunnis. In mixed neighborhoods, Shia militias drove Sunni neighbors from their homes, including Saad Juma.
They killed all my neighbors. One of them was in the square with his two small children. The militias called him by name, then shot him in the head.
Networks of local Sunni fighters joined the battle, including Abu Abed, whose brother had been so brutally murdered by the Shia government-sponsored militia.
I gave the order, defend your area, protect the people. You must guard your neighborhoods.
By the end of July, 1,855 Baghdad residents had been killed. Extremist factions were taking control of the streets. Al-Mahdi army on the Shia side and Al-Qaeda on the Sunni side. In an attempt to break the cycle of retribution, the Americans asked al-Maliki's national security advisor, Mowafaq Rubiai, to intervene and use his influence with the Shia militia. He didn't give them the answer they were hoping for.
I told General Casey that some of the Shia community felt that the Shia militia were fulfilling their duty and protecting them.
I said that it was the Shia militia and death squads that were murdering civilians in the Baghdad and area around Baghdad. That was the most dangerous long-term threat.
Well, George, the Shia militia is fighting Al-Qaeda in some of these districts. Wouldn't it be better if we leave these to fight and the winner from that fight will be much weaker, and we can deal with that weak winner much easier?
It was at that time that I realized that we had a significantly different view of the threat.
President George W. Bush had promised that the invasion of Iraq would improve the lives of its people. By 2006, he had yet to realize that the violence now gripping Iraq had left his goal, like much of the country, in ruins. A routine briefing with his top Iraq advisor, Megan O'Sullivan, would change his mind. Stephen Hadley, National Security Advisor.
The president said to Megan, knowing that she had spent several years in Baghdad and had lots of contacts in Iraq, what do your friends tell you the situation in Iraq is like?
I said, Mr. President, it's hell. Baghdad is hell. This place is a cauldron. It is consumed with killing.
This was one of his people who was committed to the Iraqi project saying to him, Mr. President, we're on the verge of failure.
The American public were clamoring to bring their troops home, but the National Security Advisor went out on a limb and suggested he do the opposite, send more troops in. A surge of thousands more troops to Baghdad in an attempt to stop the violence. President Bush was hesitant. He wasn't sure the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki could be trusted.
It was really this issue. Is he a sectarian with a sectarian agenda? Is he a non-sectarian, an agenda for all of Iraq, but simply does not have the means to deliver?
Bush decided to find out for himself. He was going to put the Prime Minister on the spot. He set out to charm him. Sami Askari was al-Maliki's advisor.
We were chatting about our problem with terrorists, and Bush said, arrest them. Prime Minister Maliki joked, there's nowhere to put them. Our jails are packed. Well, just kill them, Bush said. That made us laugh.
Before President Bush could get serious, the Iraqis offered up their own plan to end the violence. Mofak Rubai, Iraq's national security advisor.
We call it the Prime Minister Maliki Baghdad Security Plan. And we believe that was a very good plan, because what the basic principle in that is for the American troops to pull back to their barracks and to leave the streets and the communities for us.
But Bush didn't trust al-Maliki to do it on his own. So he revealed his plan, the troop surge. Brett McGurk, Iraq director for the National Security Council.
The president said, I'd be willing to deploy tens of thousands of additional U.S. forces to help you control your country, but only if I have a commitment from you on a series of things. First and foremost among them was that we could not have political interference into the targeting of the most extreme cells of the Shia militia groups. And that was really number one, because we were not going to deploy U.S. forces to babysit as Shia militias took over the streets of Baghdad.
Nouri al-Maliki realized that the Americans were not sure exactly where his loyalties lay.
The Americans weren't reassured. They were worried. They were still trying to figure me out. Was I a sectarian or a nationalist?
So, says Stephen Hadley, the president revealed the compromise he was making.
The president said, look, I know I'm asking you to do something very hard here, but I can tell you I'm about to do something very hard. I, as president of the United States, am about to increase troops when the whole country thinks I'm about to reduce the troops. This then called down credit on a bank account that the president had been investing in all these many months in developing a strong personal relationship with Maliki.
The Iraqi prime minister accepted the American conditions. President Bush now had to announce his new strategy to the American public, his last chance of achieving victory in Iraq. He made a televised statement in January 2007.
America will change our strategy to help the Iraqis carry out their campaign to put down sectarian violence and bring security to the people of Baghdad. This will require increasing American force levels. So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
Join me after the news to hear the story of the surge and the remorseless rise of Nouri al-Maliki.
The BBC World Service.
We have the headlines.
You're listening to The Newsroom, broadcasting from the heart of the BBC's new broadcasting house here in London. In the next 30 minutes...
But we go further.
That color alone has opened up Mars as a new world for me. When you grind just a little bit into the rock, Mars isn't necessarily the red planet anymore.
Telling it how it is.
They said, Shaima, you're going there at your own peril. We cannot protect you. So if Tahrir Square is a litmus test of the change in Egypt, it's not going in the right direction.
Revealing injustice.
It was police from this station who investigated the case. There are arrest warrants for the soldiers involved, but those men have not been arrested.
Reflecting on life.
When I started out, a computer was many rooms filled with huge amounts of electronics. The revolution has been enormous.
We are the BBC World Service, the world's radio station.
Coming up in the second half of the programme, how getting local Sunni militias on their side helped the US combat al-Qaeda.
The young men who were sort of the foot soldiers who would plant an IED for $50, they started coming over to our side. And they knew who was behind what was going on. So it increased our intelligence, increased the effectiveness of our targeting, and brought security to the area.
So join me, Lucy Ash, for the final part of our series on the Iraq War after the news.
BBC News with Kathy Clugston. The White House has ordered American government agencies to shut down after Republicans and Democrats in Congress fail to agree a new budget. Many government offices will close and hundreds of thousands of workers will be told to stay at home without pay. A special tribunal in Bangladesh has convicted a senior opposition leader, Salahuddin Qader Chowdhury, of war crimes committed during the country's War of Independence from Pakistan in 1971. He was found guilty of genocide, murder and abduction and was sentenced to death. Mr. Chowdhury is the first Member of Parliament and the most senior figure in the opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party to be convicted by the tribunal. A team of international disarmament experts is due in Damascus today to begin work on dismantling Syria's chemical weapons. Their mission is part of an agreement reached by the United States and Russia and endorsed by the United Nations Security Council. Syria has said it will comply with the process. South Korea has shown off new missiles during its biggest military parade in a decade. The South's president, Park Geun-hye, said her country would continue upgrading its armed forces until North Korea abandoned its nuclear weapons program. Four neo-Nazi members of the Greek parliament arrested over the weekend are due to appear in court today to present their defence arguments. They've been charged with belonging to a criminal group and with counts including murder and money laundering. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has announced a long-anticipated increase in sales tax to plug a hole in the government's finances. The tax will rise by 3% to 8% next year. The government needs to repay a public debt that's by far the highest in the developed world. An international survey has found that illicit drugs are now generally cheaper and purer than at any time in the last 20 years. The report's authors say the results raise questions about the effectiveness of policies to restrict the supply of drugs. BBC News.
Hello, I'm Lucy Ash, and welcome back to the final part in our series on the Iraq War, here on the BBC World Service. In 2007, the US increased its forces for the so-called surge against the insurgents under a new leader, General David Petraeus.
I give you my full support and wish you Godspeed.
General Petraeus's first mission would be an awkward one. Whilst his 20,000 new soldiers prepared to go into Iraq, close ally Britain was preparing to withdraw 7,000 of its troops from Iraq's southern province, Basra. General Petraeus had to change the mind of the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Petraeus flew to London.
I said the justification for keeping large numbers of troops in Basra was a lot less than the justification for surging the American troops in Baghdad, which is where the bulk of the terrorism was happening.
What I sought to do, frankly, was just to remind him of a very important dynamic, which was coalition will. And at a time when we were trying to demonstrate to the enemies on the ground that this coalition will is unshakable, that to have the number two partner in this, the most important partner for the United States, to initiate a drawdown would send a very confusing message.
I remember David Petraeus saying to me, look, you know, we understand why the situation in Basra is different, why it's sensible for the British to draw down their troops, but right at the moment we surge is not the moment to do it.
Statement of the Prime Minister.
Blair backed down and announced the change in the British Parliament in February 2007.
The UK military presence will continue into 2008 for as long as we are wanted and have a job to do.
General Petraeus flew on to Iraq from London after the bloodiest month of the entire war. Every day in January, more than 100 civilians were killed. Even in institutions which were meant to save lives, such as Iraq's Ministry of Health.
The Ministry of Health was known as a very, very dangerous organization in the grip of Shia militia leaders. To the point that Sunni Arabs, if they checked into a hospital because they were injured, feared they might not get out again except through the morgue.
The Ministry of Health was controlled by Hakim Zamili, a founder member of Muqtada al-Sadr's hardline Shia militia. Zamili also happened to be the deputy health minister. His militiamen were inside the ministry with him. Petraeus asked Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to dismiss the deputy health minister. But this was a dangerous move that could lead Muqtada al-Sadr to withdraw his backing for the government. Al-Maliki asked the general to help him.
He said, could you arrest the deputy minister of health? And I thought this was a mistranslation. I mean, think of a prime minister in the UK asking a coalition commander to arrest one of his deputy ministers. And that's what, in fact, Prime Minister Maliki wanted.
The minister was arrested. But that didn't stop the sectarian killing, which was sweeping Baghdad. The city had formerly been made up of mixed neighbourhoods where Shia and Sunni lived side by side. Now it had transformed into Shia and Sunni enclaves, and the Sunnis were the biggest losers. General Petraeus decided to send his troops to live in the warring neighbourhoods to separate the rival factions. He knew he needed to do more, a political solution as well as a military one. So he ordered his British number two, General Graham Lamb, to look amongst the enemy for some who might be persuaded to stop fighting.
If your brother, your sister, or your uncle, or your aunt, you know, spent his last days chained to a chair, being black and deckered to death, then that person's going to have a pretty unreasonable, damned attitude to, oh, let's be reasonable here, peace will prevail, just give peace a chance. But it doesn't mean that they're naturally irreconcilable or just lost to humanity.
It was a difficult but not impossible task. General Lamb not only had to win over his enemies, but also some of his US allied commanders, in particular Ray Odierno, commander of the multinational force.
As he was initially walking me through this and said, we need to reconcile with some of these people, I said, I will not reconcile, or it'll be difficult for me to reconcile with anybody with blood on their hands.
Oh, just turn around and say, we've both got bloody, we're covered in blood. But if you discard those who've been fighting against us from an opportunity to dialogue, then the truth is, this can't work.
The generals agreed to look for insurgents they could work with. Al-Qaeda inadvertently gave them an opportunity. In the spring of 2007, Al-Qaeda met the American surge with a counter-offensive of suicide attacks and roadside bombs. In one Baghdad neighborhood, they killed seven US troops with just one bomb. The district of Amariya was Al-Qaeda's most important stronghold in Baghdad. They'd gained control by protecting local Sunnis from Shia violence. They had then turned it into the capital of their own Islamic state, where they imposed strict religious law. And for one Sunni leader, Abu Abed, it had gone too far.
I saw some Al-Qaeda men running. They were carrying guns. One of them crept up behind a family. He killed both children, left in the street. I shouted, what did they do wrong? He said, want to be next? I said, no, man, you're the law and you're the state.
Abu Abed decided it was time to reclaim the neighbourhood. Someone told Commander Dale Cool.
He said, we're going to attack Al-Qaeda tomorrow. We need to do this. This needs to be the people of Amariya. So I told him, okay, do not point your weapons at my soldiers. Do not point your weapons at any civilians. If you do, we'll kill you. And then I wished him good luck.
The clashes began. The battle was fierce. The blow Al-Qaeda suffered that day broke its back.
Abu Abed and his men celebrated. Too soon. The next day, Al-Qaeda forces returned and drove the locals back to a single, isolated mosque. Abu Abed's forces were trapped.
One of my men said to me, what shall we do, Abu Abed? We are surrounded. Just then I heard machine guns, heavy machine guns. They were very loud, not ordinary assault rifles. It was the US Army.
The cavalry had truly arrived. In fact, to be precise, the US 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry. The rescue of local Sunnis was the opportunity the Americans needed to get the Sunni insurgents on side. They began negotiations to organize and pay Abu Abed's local fighters. In return, the Sunnis would maintain local security and keep Al-Qaeda out. Within months, tens of thousands of Sunnis across Baghdad were on the US government payroll. General Petraeus was making progress at last.
Local Iraqis are throwing in with us, and that's something that we have to build on. There is some momentum, and it's something we have to capitalize on now and make the most of while we have all of our forces here.
General Petraeus asked Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to incorporate the volunteers into the Iraq security forces. But the Shia leader was suspicious of the Sunni fighters.
I asked General Petraeus, why didn't you consult us about this earlier? We're trying to get rid of militias. You could be creating a new militia. These men are all from one sect.
Ryan Crocker, US ambassador to Iraq, tried to persuade al-Maliki it was in his best interests.
The main argument we used was, look, we've expended a lot of effort to take these guys out of the fight. You don't want to push them back into it.
I said, OK, give us their names so we know who they are. Are they for real?
To make sure they weren't double-crossed, the Americans recorded the recruits' DNA and took fingerprints and retina scans. It paid off. Commander Dale Kuhl.
The young men who were sort of the foot soldiers who would plant an IED for $50, they started coming over to our side. And they knew who was behind what was going on. So it increased our intelligence, increased the effectiveness of our targeting, and brought security to the area.
Now they had the intelligence, U.S. forces went after al-Qaeda's hardcore. In September 2007, the level of sectarian killing finally began to drop. Prime Minister al-Maliki agreed to incorporate 20% of the Sunni volunteers into Iraq's security forces. He also took greater control of them. He took charge of appointing senior officers, and the country's elite special forces would now report directly to him. Despite this strong leadership, he still hadn't confronted the Shia militias. In early 2008, Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army made a challenge the prime minister couldn't ignore. They took control in Iraq's southern capital, Basra, after the British forces had finally pulled out. Al-Maliki had to act.
The whole place was being run by the militias. I decided to go there with all the forces I could muster.
Most of Iraq's oil exports flow through Basra, the country's only port. Whoever controls Basra controls 70% of the country's revenue. Al-Maliki would risk everything to save Basra. On the 22nd of March, the Prime Minister summoned General Petraeus.
He said that he was going to move to Basra himself with his principal ministers and his own security brigade, and he was ordering four Iraqi brigades down there immediately to deal with the situation in Basra.
General Petraeus's view was that going to Basra was a big mistake. To get the militias out of Basra would take serious planning. It would be at least 6 months before we could retake the city.
I said, Prime Minister, you know, whenever I've briefed you before, we always had what we called the setting the conditions phase of the operation. And we moved the attack helicopters, the Predators, the close air support aircraft, the medical evacuation, logistics, you name it. It all has to be moved down to support your forces.
I said, thank you, but I'm going. You stay in Baghdad. I want nothing from you but air transport.
General Petraeus alerted the U.S. ambassador, Ryan Crocker.
Dave was there, called me immediately and said, you know, oh my God.
As the prime minister traveled to Basra.
We thought it would be easy, but when we arrived in Basra, the air was alight with shells, missiles, bullets. It was a battlefield.
Al-Maliki had called the Mahdi army criminals and announced that they would be arrested. Their leader, Muqtada al-Sadr, told him to get out of town.
I had to mobilise the Mahdi army because the government has neglected its duty.
It should take care of the people and not mount attacks, raids, wars and confrontations.
Muqtada's army quickly repelled the government forces. They showered rocket and mortars on al-Maliki, who was holed up in the presidential palace. He called Petraeus and Crocker.
General Petraeus and I were communicating with the prime minister by cell phone, huddled in my office, and suggesting at one point that perhaps the wisest thing to do would be to declare a victory reposition, reconsolidate his forces before he lost them all.
They thought I was besieged. I was not. I was determined.
I said, Prime Minister, you've gotten into a desperate situation. You could lose. The militia, these gangs, these criminals could actually defeat your forces.
I said, it's our country, it's our decision, it's our risk. I would return as a victor to Baghdad, or as a corpse.
The Prime Minister announced his decision during a CNN interview.
We are determined not to quit Basra. We won't leave Basra until we establish security and punish the criminals.
In Washington, President Bush was warned that al-Maliki's forces were losing badly. Brett McGurk, Iraq Director, National Security Council.
I had in my hand a series of maps which showed that the Iraqi army units in Basra at the time were surrounded, unable to resupply, and surrounded by militias.
There was some questioning about whether there should be wholehearted support for someone who had taken such a rash decision.
The president came charging from behind his desk and said, "Don't tell me this is a bad thing."
Finally, the Iraqis were doing what he'd hoped they would do all along. Steve Hadley, National Security Advisor.
The president said, this is the Iraqis stepping up. We need to ensure that Maliki succeeds. So, turning to the military, your job, General, is not to get him to come back. Your job is to get a team over there that helps him succeed.
The Iraqis had no air power. General Petraeus ordered attack helicopters and armed drones down to Basra. Prime Minister al-Maliki took control of the city. He seized the opportunity to present Muqtada al-Sadr with an ultimatum: give up the militia or his political movement. The Prime Minister announced his decision during a CNN interview.
A decision was taken that from today they cannot take part in elections unless they disband the Mahdi army. Thank you very much.
Muqtada called a permanent ceasefire. It appeared to be the end of the Mahdi army and a great victory for the Prime Minister. Now the Americans had helped al-Maliki defeat both his Shia and Sunni enemies, he thought he could go it alone. He told President Bush he wanted a firm date for the withdrawal of US troops. He gave al-Maliki his wish. On the 14th of December 2008, he flew to Baghdad to host a joint press conference with the Prime Minister.
The agreement lays out a framework for the withdrawal of American forces in Iraq, a withdrawal that is possible because of the success of the surge.
The president was preparing to go out on a high, but one man in the conference had other ideas.
Okay, everybody calm down for a minute.
A protester threw a shoe at the president. A serious insult in Arab culture.
If you want the facts, it's a size 10 shoe that he threw.
Prime Minister al-Maliki was mortified.
I was monumentally embarrassed. I'm an Arab, a Muslim. Hospitality and respect for our guests are important.
Despite the embarrassment, he fixed a date with President Bush for the Americans to go home. But had it come at too high a cost for his countrymen? Al-Maliki's political opponents argued that he was starting to destroy Iraq's democracy. As the next election approached, they claimed he was using the police and intelligence services against them.
The atmosphere is characterized by arrests and raids, exclusion,
ostracizing, marginalization, and intimidation.
Former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi led a new party called Iraqiya, a coalition of 10 secular and Sunni parties. They ran as non-religious, non-sectarian opponents to Maliki.
It was clear to me that the country is going out of the way and the political process is being compromised completely.
In February 2010, just weeks before the election, 66 of Iraqiya's candidates were disqualified. They were allegedly connected to the Saddam regime. Salah Mutlak, one of the accused, spoke to a TV reporter.
We don't know how to appeal. We send the letter to the court, but we don't have a way to defend ourselves.
Mutlak had been one of the first Sunni leaders to take the risk of working with Shia governments. He was bewildered by the disqualification.
I joined the political process and helped write our constitution. I'd stood in elections and won. Nobody expected me to be disqualified. I broke with the old regime more than 30 years ago. They got my relatives to confess to terrorist activity in order to implicate me. But when my relatives were brought to trial, the court saw evidence of torture on their bodies. A retrial was ordered, and they were found not guilty.
Despite the intimidation of their candidates, Al-Araqiya won two more seats than Al-Maliki. Al-Maliki demanded a recount, but failed to realise how independent the Independent Electoral Commission really was, recalls his advisor, Sami Askari.
The recount was done, but incorrectly. It failed to alter the result.
Eventually, the two sides signed an agreement to share power, with Nouri al-Maliki to continue as prime minister. Al-Araqiya would get three of the government's top posts, including the position of deputy prime minister for Salah Mutlak. And there were specific checks on al-Maliki's exercise of power. Or that's how Ayad Alawi, leader of the Al-Araqiya party, understood it.
I said to Maliki that if you embark on the power sharing and implement the agreement, then we will be one party, one side, one team. Unfortunately, he never implemented, ultimately, the power sharing.
Within 3 months, thousands of protesters were on the streets. Angry crowds tried to storm government buildings. Al-Maliki's forces killed 23 protesters. Over the next few months, more than 600 Sunni were arrested, including the head of the Electoral Commission, all under the authority of the Interior Minister, a job to which al-Maliki had appointed himself.
Those who oppose the political process are al-Qaeda and Saddam's party.
The new US administration continued to back al-Maliki. In December 2011, President Obama invited al-Maliki to Washington to mark the end of the Americans' mission in Iraq.
Today I'm proud to welcome Prime Minister Maliki, the elected leader of a sovereign, self-reliant, and democratic Iraq. The Prime Minister leads Iraq's most inclusive government yet.
It was not an Iraq that Deputy Prime Minister Saleh Mutlak recognized. He gave an interview to CNN.
This is a one-party show and one-man show. Yes, al-Maliki is the most dictator we have ever seen in our history.
The Prime Minister was not amused.
I didn't take his statement seriously. It was just an attempt to sour the mood during my visit.
2 days later, Mutlak had some unexpected visitors.
Tanks and soldiers were outside my headquarters. It was completely under siege. You couldn't even get a piece of bread into the place.
Iraqiya party leader Ayad Alawi was watching closely.
The Iraqiya people called me and they said that there is a wave of arrest and tanks are surrounding us.
An elite army unit commanded by al-Maliki's son was pointing its guns at three of al-Araqiya's top leaders. The Prime Minister argued it was part of a judicial investigation into the Sunni Vice President, Tariq al-Hashimi.
I got a text that some of Hashimi's bodyguards had been arrested in connection with a car bombing.
General David Petraeus, now director of the CIA, flew to Baghdad.
I went in to see Prime Minister Maliki. He would rightly point out that these were legal arrest warrants that were issued to the police and executed. But frankly, there were no arrest warrants for the Shia militia bodyguards of the Shia politicians who had plenty of blood on their hands. So it seemed as if this was an exclusively Sunni affliction visited on them by a Shia predominant government.
The leadership of al-Araqiya met at the vice president's house, which was still surrounded by armoured vehicles. Ayad Alawi felt Iraq's short-lived democracy was already over.
The meeting was very tense. The tanks were obvious outside. And you could see that the body language that democracy is finished in the country. You could see it, you could read it in the eyes.
Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi left the country fearing arrest. In his absence, he's been found guilty of orchestrating murder and sentenced to death five times. Al-Maliki's government continued to target al-Araqiya. The bodyguards of key members were arrested one after another. They were interrogated and confessed to crimes, implicating their bosses in terrorism. One bodyguard died in custody. Al-Maliki justified his actions in a press conference.
We cannot relax our actions. Yes, the law might be brutal, but it must be tough, because terrorism engulfs all Iraqis.
Sunni demonstrations increased. Al-Maliki again sent in troops. Sunnis began to attack police and army units. April 2013 marked 10 years since Saddam had been defeated. It should have been a time of celebration. Instead, that month, Iraqis buried more than 700 victims of sectarian violence, the highest level in 5 years. Al-Maliki banned journalists from Al Jazeera and 9 other television channels. The Americans and British had achieved their main objective, removal of Saddam Hussein. But more than 170,000 Iraqis have since died. The new Iraq is hardly what the liberators had in mind. I'm Lucy Ash, and you've been listening to the final part of the Iraq War. The series is a Brooke Lapping production. The series producer was Norma Percy. It was produced for radio by Julie Ball.